AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. A dire development in Dallas.
A preliminary blood test on a caregiver at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, Dallas, proved positive for Ebola.
The hospital's chief clinical officer, Dr. Daniel Vargas, says the healthcare worker treated Thomas Eric Duncan, the first person diagnosed with Ebola and the first person to die of the disease in this country. He adds that the unidentified worker had a low-grade fever Friday, and the preliminary test confirmed the diagnosis yesterday.
Patient's condition is stable. A close contact has also been proactively placed in isolation.
The CDC is doing a follow-up confirmation of that test. Duncan's family members say hospital officials in Dallas were reluctant to tell them what happened to him. Josephus Weeks, nephew of Thomas Eric Duncan, says he had a hard time getting the hospital to turn over the medical records.
I had to get loud in the hospital with the president and most of his staff and got him, you know, to get moving to get me those records because I needed them so I could leave Dallas.
Liberian officials are pleading with nurses and physician assistants to be at work tomorrow amid a dispute over hazard pay that has prompted calls for a strike in the middle of the Ebola epidemic. An assistant health minister says such a walkout would have very negative consequences for the fight against Ebola. The healthcare workers want $700 a month in hazard pay on top of their normal monthly salaries of somewhere around $200 or $300 a month. Protesters from across the country are in St. Louis for what organizers are calling Ferguson October, marking the 2 months since black 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed in a confrontation with a white police officer in the St. Louis suburb.
We will do anything in our power to ensure that everyone in this city has equal rights and will not be discriminated against.
This is AP Radio News. Bermuda bracing for rough weather. Tropical Storm Fay drawing near the British territory off the East Coast. National Hurricane Center meteorologist Daniel Brown says Fay is a pretty strong storm.
We've had winds as high as 53 miles per hour with a gust of 67 miles per hour reported over portions of the island.
Two much stronger storms are hitting Asia. 14 million people in India in the path of Cyclone Hudhud and its 120-mile-per-hour winds. Typhoon Vongfong is moving north toward Japan's main islands. About 140,000 people have been warned to evacuate there. One person is dead, another in critical condition after they were hit by a passenger train in California. Santa Barbara County fire officials say two men and two women were on a trestle taking photos around sunset when the train approached. The four tried to run off the trestle. A woman was killed. Another had moderate injuries, while a man has head and upper body injuries. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
This Sunday, we'll be joined by Mark Furstenberg. You know him from his famous breads at Bread First, and he's bringing with him the elusive Frank Ruda. They're going to be cooking together. And also, Capital Teas is coming in. They're going to soothe us with some delicious teas.
That's Foodie and the Beast this Sunday at 11, right here on 1500 AM.
Come to the National Academy of Public Administration annual meeting Thursday, November 13th at the DoubleTree in Crystal City. This year's event, Public Administration 2025, How Will Government Adapt?, brings together federal, state, local, and international leaders to find solutions to the greatest challenges facing our nation's governments. The event features an impressive array of speakers from across government, including OPM Director Catherine Archuleta and officials from executive and legislative branch agencies. For more information and to register, visit napawash.org. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Optifor Integrated Wealth Management. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn. Today's show involves a great lineup of guests for you. Mark, would you please run through that lineup?
Wes, we have a terrific lineup. First off is Scott DiGiammarino, the CEO and founder of Real Potential. Second is Jim Burris, the president and CEO of Ashburn Consulting. Third is Cameron Kahn, the president and CEO of Search Technologies. And number four is Kevin Opre, the president and CEO of Obsidian Analysis.
First guest is going to be Scott DiGiammarino, Scott of Real Potential. Scott, what is Real Potential?
Well, thank you for having me. What we do is we use Hollywood movie clips to help business leaders galvanize their organizations and principal thought and action.
And where'd you get the idea for this?
I ran American Express Financial Advisors for the East Coast for 25 years, and we had about 1,600 people working for us and over 200-plus offices.
Uh-huh.
And we're trying to figure out a way to motivate and inspire people and to get people to make principle-based decisions on an ongoing basis without me physically having to be in their offices.
So you just show movies?
Well, we'd send out a weekly email that was themed. Perseverance, uh-huh. Courage, teamwork, hope, some principle, a universal principle. I type up why I say courage was important. And I would say it kind of reminds me of the movie Top Gun starring Tom Cruise. And for those of you who are interested, here's what it's all about. And we'd send that out every single week to people.
So how did you know there was a business there?
We had best-in-class metrics for over 25 years on both hard and soft numbers. You know, your hard numbers like your year-over-year growth, et cetera, but more importantly, soft numbers such as leadership impact and employee engagement scores. Amex sent in McKinsey as well as a number of other consulting firms to check mm-hmm. us out to see if what we're doing was legal. And they came away saying that that this movie clip culture and this, quite frankly, this story-sharing culture that we had built was very creative and unique, and they called it our secret sauce.
So what is it about those clips that kind of resonated with people that said there's something really here?
They inspire people. They motivate people. They're compelling. Sometimes they make you laugh. Sometimes they make you cry. But there's a statistic out there that we found that 82% of individuals actually can remember the emotion and remember the clip itself when they're by themselves.
Yeah, so how does that translate into to results, like you were saying, all these metrics?
So if your goal is to get 10 appointments a week, let's say you're in a sales organization, that's Friday at 4:30 or 4:59, you have a choice. Do I go home or do I make that extra phone call, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you'll hopefully remember the clip from Castaway, and what would Tom Hanks do at this particular moment?
Mm-hmm. So for you, what inspired you growing up as a kid?
I wanted success. Everything when I was growing up was hard. It was never easy. And we had to learn what we called Hustle 101.
Who instilled that in you that said you had to learn that?
Oh, clearly my father.
What was Dad doing?
Dad was a school teacher and assistant principal at a high school, but he was also my football and baseball coach growing up. And he essentially said to us, we were little, you know, 5'7", 135 pounds.
We meaning?
Myself and my two brothers,
okay.
Two younger brothers. So what we had to essentially do is we had to fight for every inch. We had to claw our way up to the top so we could be victorious in whatever we did.
Really? He was instilling competition in you among the kids?
Very much so.
Why did he think that was important?
He knew the world was challenging, and he knew that once we left the nest that we would have to fight for ourselves. Huh. And so that happened when we were playing sports. That happened through high school. It definitely happened in college and then when I was at American Express.
You said he coached you football too. Which was he harder at?
Definitely.
That is on you, you as a kid.
Definitely football.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, how come?
We were playing against kids that were twice our size. And so, you know, when I played quarterback,
odds were against you. They were stacked against you from the beginning just because of your size.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so what we had to do is we had to fight. We had to believe in ourselves. And he constantly said, don't ever let anyone tell you that you can't do something.
Sounds like he was an important person in your life.
Still is. He's my hero.
Huh. Is he surprised by your success today?
When I joined American Express right out of college, it was a straight commission-based job. And he said, what are you doing? I paid XYZ amount of dollars for you to go to college.
So you can get a good, steady income.
Exactly,
that, right?
Exactly. But over time, he understood why I did what I did and took the risk we did at a tender age of 22. We stayed in touch, even though I was in Washington, D.C., and he was in Boston. And we kept communicating the good, the bad, and the ugly on a day-to-day basis.
What do you think, in hindsight, did he see something in you that actually gave him the confidence that you made the right decision for you then?
At the time, I don't think he did. I think I went to a place called Babson College, which is a school of entrepreneurs, which I couldn't even spell entrepreneur back when I was 18 years mm-hmm. old. But I think he saw that I had what I call the 5 D's, which is drive, determination, discipline, desire, and ability to make great decisions in the face of adversity.
And as a youngster, that was genetically encoded in you? Had that kind
that
of
was, that was preached to me. By my family, yes.
Mom included. What was mom doing?
Mom was worked at a hospital as an administrative assistant for a number of years.
So you guys were basically latchkey kids.
Yes.
You were the oldest?
I was the oldest, yes.
So did responsibility for the kids fall to you? I don't know how big of an age spread.
It's back to back. My brothers and I were very competitive with one another. We were very, very different than one another. We fended for ourselves, but every night, I'll tell you, the greatest thing is every single night we were home for dinner with the entire family.
That was an important piece of growing up in your household?
Especially an Italian household.
So what was the conversation like around the dinner table?
It was very much a lot of listening. Tell us about your day, what went well. It was very positive in nature, very focused on tell me something good that happened today. My mother used to always say, did you laugh today?
Really?
She says that even today. Tell me something that made you laugh today.
Why was that something that she thought was important?
I think the majority of life, according to them, wasn't always positive. And I think they wanted us to focus on the positives and what could be.
So, Scott, I want to take you back to Real Technology. So for our listeners, Real is a movie reel, not like...
Yeah, R-E-E-L. It's R-E-E-L. Real Potential. Real
I'm sorry,
Potential.
Real Potential.
Yep.
And you were working at American Express, and how long did it take you to get set up to do Real Potential?
When I got to American Express in 1992, took over the D.C. region, the region was ranked 173rd out of 176. It was a disaster zone.
Why would you even walk into that?
My wife asked me the same question all the time because I believed in people and I wanted to take the next step up. And leaving Boston to come here was a big step for us because my oldest was only 6 months old. But in 1 year, we went from number 173 to number one, and we maintained that ranking for over 20 years of both hard numbers and soft numbers. But part of our strategy was to get the best out of everybody. And that's so about 6 years in, we started sending out weekly emails to people that were theme-based, courage, perseverance, hope, and we tied in with a movie clip.
How did you get those movie clips?
Well, at the time, back in the 80s, we had no idea they were... We had no idea that it was copyright law and things like that. But we learned quickly back in the early 90s. So what ended up happening was it worked so well that we started approaching the Hollywood studios back in the late 90s saying, look, I got something here. It's working for a Fortune 50 company. I'd love to see if we can help change the world and make people feel great and inspired that they can do anything by using movies. And it took 9.5 years of negotiation with Hollywood to finally get a yes.
Why would you continue? Why would you persevere as opposed to, oh, come on, there's other things to do rather than that?
That's a great question. You know what it is? I saw people that worked for me that struggled early in their career, started seeing these movie clips on a day-to-day basis, and all of a sudden they accomplished some incredible things. The stories I could tell you mm-hmm. about the turnaround of people's not only business life but personal life, and if you ask them today about why it happened, they would pick a movie. the scene I saw in Apollo 13, the Braveheart clip when he was talking about passion and courage, basically helped change their lives.
Is there one that changed yours?
I love Apollo 13 when they said failure is not an option.
So failure is not an option for you?
No.
Can you give an example of against all odds? Because Apollo 13 had some fairly overwhelming odds there.
Essentially leaving American Express, which was a very great job as a senior executive after 25 years, and starting your own company by yourself. You know, back in 2010, was against all odds.
I'm going to go inspire people.
Exactly. And people say, what are you doing? What are you thinking? And I just believe in people.
Hmm. Where does that belief come from?
Clearly, my parents' belief in me.
Really?
Yes.
Where did the perseverance come from?
I would relate it back to my days playing sports in high school. Okay. Even before that, where going back to smallest kid in the field. With the biggest heart, never want to give, never give up.
Hmm. So, today, in what you do with your company, even though it still sounds like it's fairly early in its formative stages, so what keeps you going? I mean, against all the things that basically, and there are odds that are against you being successful at this, what keeps you going?
It's funny, yeah. When we did the deal with Hollywood, they gave me access to 4,800 movies, which I had to watch almost all of them. And there are scenes in these movies that today inspire me and motivate me and get me to tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I want to take that exact same emotion and get it to the millions of people in the world.
That's great, Scott. Scott, what's the website address?
www.realpotential.com.
We've been speaking with Scott DiGiamarino. He's the CEO and founder of Real Potential. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn, for helping with the interview. And don't forget to listen to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offutt Kerman. What is Offutt Kerman, Doug?
Offutt Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tysons Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into too particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying, and we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying. And since then, he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offuttkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offutt Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn. For this segment, we've got Jim Burris, president and CEO of Ashburn Consulting. Welcome, Jim. Jim, what is Ashburn Consulting?
Thank you for asking. Ashburn Consulting is an IT professional services company that specializes in network and network security engineering solutions for clients in the commercial, federal, and state and local.
And how big or small is it?
Currently, we have 45 employees and around $10 million in revenue.
And you started this company, or how did you come to be there?
No, there was a founder who started in 2002. We used to work together at UUNet in the late 90s and asked me and another partner to join in 2005.
So why did he ask you, well, I'm not worried about your other partner right now, but why did he ask you?
Well, you know, we definitely worked together well when we were at UUNet, and just a quick story was I was the only one that was not homegrown UUNet. I came from Booz Allen and Hamilton into the group, so we were a small niche consulting group out of UUNet, and so yeah, he just saw good qualities and something that attracted me to him. So.
And you left the confines of a fairly secure environment to go work for a fairly small company at the time.
That's right.
So what were you thinking?
First of all, my wife was asking me if I was crazy, but you know, I think I had an entrepreneurial spirit in me, and you know, I think that what we've seen in larger companies is that, you know, they work their employees hard, and it's not that we're adverse to working hard. It's we wanted to ensure that we treat our employees well, and we compensate for the, you know, them for you know, working hard as well.
So where does the entrepreneurial spirit for you show up as a kid? What was your first paying job, perhaps?
Well, first paying job was, you know, middle school, just delivering papers. But I think the entrepreneurial spirit really just developed over time. Just the hard work and ethic has also developed over time.
Where's the hard work come from? What was mom or dad doing?
Well, my dad, he was in the Army, and he had actually retired from the Army and then became a radiology technician in the area. And
a second career he chose?
Second career, and, you know, really worked hard in the sense that he, you know, worked two jobs to put three of us through college. So
three of you meaning brothers, sisters?
Two older sisters, right.
So you're the youngest?
Youngest, that's correct.
So here he is, he's a career Army.
Career
person.
Army, yep.
And he decides after however many years to go into an entirely...
Well, that was his training, I think, in the Army. But he capitalized that and made it a career.
Uh-huh. And what about mom?
My mom, she, you know, they got married early and young. And she came to the States in the 60s. And, you know, for her...
Were they married here or married...
Married here in the States. And for her, you know, it was a totally different environment. No friends, left family, came to the United States, and I think it was a challenge for her.
I would suspect that's pretty scary.
It was, yeah, very scary for her.
Where did she come from?
She was she's South Korean, so she grew up in Seoul, in the capital, and then and obviously again she just migrated here and. It was a challenge for her, I think, you know, just a new environment, different culture, different people. And
did she speak to you about it and what it was like?
You know, honestly, she didn't. I mean, she picked up English as we were growing up. So
she didn't even speak the language.
No, she really kept a lot of that to herself. But I think what I got from her was the determination to succeed and, you know, the sense of family. I think that...
Did you ever get a chance to go back to Seoul and visit her side of the family?
Not yet. She did. We did. She had her older sister come to the States, and their family lived with us for a number of years before they got settled. But so I have two cousins that are here in the States, and my aunt and uncle were here as well from my mom's side.
Mm-hmm. So here's a lady that doesn't speak the language, doesn't know the culture. Comes over what I suspect is a fairly tumultuous time in the history of this country.
Right.
Settles with your dad in an unknown place and starts to put house together?
Yeah, and, you know, again, we didn't grow up with much. So I think, you know, what really drove my parents was the fact that they wanted to see us succeed or, you know, just have a better life. So... You know, education and was very important to my parents. So it was, you know, going to college was not an option. It's
you had to.
We had to. So.
So, you said you didn't grow up with a whole lot of money necessarily. So, How'd you pay for that?
Well, we just, you know, God's providence, we survived. And, you know, I think, and, you know, for us, the kids, we really didn't ask for much. It's, you know, everything was sort of, you know, blessing. And I think all of us really appreciated the things that we did have. So I think in the, you know, how that brought me to where I am today, mm-hmm. I think from an employee perspective, we want to treat our employees very well. We pay 100% healthcare. We 6% 401k match. So there's a lot of things that are just within me that, you know, we want to give back.
You had said something earlier in the green room about everybody kind of pitching in and contribute, which I thought was a fairly powerful statement. Where does that lesson come from, and how does that show up in what you do now?
Well, I think it really was just embedded in me, was that, hey, we all have to work hard to succeed. And so all the partners are billable. And so I think from a partner's perspective, we would never ask our employees to do anything that we wouldn't be willing to do. So we all have been billable up until about 2 years ago, where I went unbillable. And now I'm back billable to a client.
Mm-hmm. So nothing was handed to you. So how did you get? Did you have to work your way through college, or?
Yeah, you know, my father and parents, they wanted to ensure that we had to work for the things that we received. So although my parents paid for my college, I had to pay for my books, or the incidental charges I had to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
So and luckily, my middle sister, she had a full scholarship.
Oh, she did?
Yeah, to Clemson.
How did she get the scholarship?
She, by chance, became a shot putter in high school. And
a shot putter?
A shot putter. And and this must have been a talent that the track coach saw in her and picked her out. And, you know, she won states 3 years in a row.
Did that make it easier or more difficult for you in terms of what you had to do and the contribution you had to make?
Well, first in high school, she's on the Hall of Fame, so it probably made it a little easier just for me to, her younger brother, you know, she could probably protect me a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I did play basketball throughout high school, and, you know, so I think, you know, all of us were generally talented in athletics, and I think some of that sort of nurtured into the people that we are today.
What angle did you get from basketball that kind of stays with you?
The ability to work in a team, right? So to achieve a common goal, everyone had a role to play and a duty to make sure that we met that goal. So I think that was naturally working in team environments, looking at everyone's strengths and weaknesses, I think definitely helped into my career today.
Is that something that that you bring uniquely to the table that, you know, the folks that work for you appreciate?
Possibly. I think generally, you know, I think the team members see that there's leadership, there's integrity, there's hard work, which I think naturally just comes out.
Jim, what's your college degree in?
Undergraduate degree was in finance, and then my graduate degree was in telecommunications management.
So it's not technical?
Both were not technical.
But you're working at a technical company.
Yes, that's correct. And so, you know, just right out of school, undergraduate, I became a research analyst for a patent law firm, then went to graduate school night, finished my graduate degree, and got my degree in telecommunications management. Worked for Booz Allen on a NASA contract for a number of years, and decided that I wanted to get hands-on technical. And so at that point, I went to UUNET.
Yeah, we're at the end of our time here, so there's a lot more here that we'd probably get out of this. What's the website address, Jim?
It's ashburnconsulting.com.
Thanks, Jim. We've been speaking with Jim Burris, President and CEO of Ashburn Consulting. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn, for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And we'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. Welcome, Jody. Jody, what is Acumetrics?
Acumetrics is a firm that works with CEOs that are interested in growing their revenues and bottom lines in a scalable, sustainable way.
And what's your role within the company?
I'm the founder and president.
And what is it about the job that you bring that's so unique to you, that special gift, as we say?
That special gift? I enjoy working with the CEOs to have them achieve goals that they thought were impossible.
And what is it about the organization that makes it so special?
We work, our clients say that it's the three Ps: our people, our platform, and our processes. Our people are highly qualified and they're fun to work with. Mm-hmm. Our processes are enabling of reliable and timely financial information, and our platform is scalable.
And who is, or what is perhaps, the perfect client for you?
Businesses of any size that want reliable, timely financial information.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I enjoy working with the clients and making a difference. We like to help the CEOs understand their financial information so they can make different choices tomorrow to impact future results of the business.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.acumetricsllc.com.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Les.
We've been speaking with Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. This is Les Smollett, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn. For this segment, we've got Cameron Kahn, President and CEO of Search Technologies. Welcome, Cameron.
Thank you.
Cameron, what is Search Technologies?
Search Technologies is the leading IT services company that's dedicated to building search solutions on traditional search engines and big data.
Mm-hmm. And how big or small is it?
We're about 150 people, and we're growing to 170 people.
And you've done that since when?
We started the company in 2005.
So that's when they hired you, right?
Well, I founded a company with my business partners, and over the last 9 and change years, we've grown the company to about 150 people.
And so for you, this was an idea that, what, its time had come? How did you decide I'm going to do this?
Well, I was working for a company that was focused on selling products in the search space. And while we were very successful doing that, what we did see is that many companies were not using the products as well as they could be. And so we decided that we'd form a services company to go back and leverage the investment they'd made, sometimes millions of dollars, in products, and help them get the most out of those search products.
So did you do that with the blessing of the company you had left?
I was, yes, absolutely. They were one of our partners when we first started, because most companies who are selling products, they are focused on selling products. Typically, they're public, and they don't want to do professional services. So we ended up partnering with that company and others like them.
Hmm. Cameron, can you give examples of the kind of things your company does?
Yeah, absolutely. We're building websites that are very search-centric. So one example is the National Archives. We're in the middle of a project right now where we're helping them get a lot of their content online. Eventually, it'll be 1 billion records over the next few years that they want to publish to the public. So we have some government customers like that. We have some commercial customers, too. We have over 600 customers, actually, and some of our commercial customers are publishers who want to publish their content and make it searchable, mm-hmm. and others are just indexing information inside their own firewalls for productivity reasons.
So why did you choose 4 partners to go into business with, yourself included, as opposed to just do this on your own?
Well, when we started the company, there were, we had a partner in the UK who'd already started a similar business that we felt we could leverage off. And the other two guys were people who'd worked with me for many years, and we had complementary skill sets. And so it just made sense to put the 4 of us together, and that gave us the best chance to build a great company.
As opposed to what? You could own the whole show yourself and all the riches will come to you?
Yeah, I could own the whole show myself, but probably not grow the company because I didn't have these complementary skills. One of my partners was on the technical side, the other was on the commercial side.
So what is it about you, perhaps when you were growing up, that you realized that, you know, bringing people together like this was maybe a skill that you had that was going to be helpful?
Yeah, well, I've always been a people person, and I've always enjoyed building teams. And I guess, you know, one of the early things that I would say is that, like many English people, I'm a soccer fan, and playing soccer was something I did very regularly, and mm-hmm. you know, helping to build a good team like that was probably the earliest that I noticed that this was a skill I had. And throughout my life, I've enjoyed looking at people's strengths and trying to bring people together.
When did you know you had the ability to actually see the strengths that people had?
I mean, I think I've had that from a very early age with my colleagues at work. I started work at 21 years old in the software business, and I'd always I was on the sales side, and I was always working in teams, and so I was able to see that certain people were good at certain things, and we would work together to achieve what we needed to achieve.
I always thought people in sales were always working for themselves, more or less.
Well, you can't be successful unless you leverage everybody around you, because you know selling is only one part of the overall solution. You've got to deliver, and you've got to give value to the customer. And
where
so,
did you learn that?
Where did I learn?
The fact that actually you're just one piece of a bigger puzzle, that actually for the team to be successful, everybody's got to have their hand in it, if you will.
Well, I mean, in a business context, I learned that when I first started work. You know, I was able to help the company grow. It was a relatively small company. We grew to about 200 people, and I did my part. And I was working inside teams. But prior to that, as a younger person, whether it was sports or at school, I think that's where I ended up learning that.
And so you didn't grow up here in the States. Sounds like you have an accent that's from, what, England?
Yeah, I grew up in Manchester in the UK,
uh-huh.
and lived in a couple other places before I moved to the US in 97.
What was Dad doing?
My dad was, he emigrated from Pakistan with my mom back in the late 50s, and he was eventually ended up working in quality assurance for a local company.
So what is it that kind of made them leave Pakistan and come to the UK?
Well, in those days, there was quite a lot of immigration from the Indian subcontinent, and the main reason was really that he wanted to have a better life for his children, and so he moved to the UK. He felt there was more opportunity.
Were you born in the UK?
Or? I was born in Manchester, yes. Yeah.
Okay. And so Dad was in quality assurance. Is he still alive, I'm assuming?
No, actually, he passed away a few years ago.
Sorry. So what do you remember most about him?
Oh, you know, he was a very caring, hardworking person who cared about his family and wanted his kids really to be educated and have a better life for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And is there something in particular that you got from him that still resonates with you today and shows up in the way you lead?
Yeah, I think, you know, he cared about people. He wanted everybody to work hard, but also feel that they were respected. And that's something that I think I got from my father.
Mm-hmm. And you were one of how many children?
I was one of five.
One of five, and you're somewhere in what order?
I was right in the middle, so I had an older brother and older sister, and a younger brother and younger sister.
So were they also born in the UK?
Yes, everybody was born in the UK.
So what's it like being in the middle of five?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I didn't notice it at the time, but as you know, for me, I had an older brother and older sister that I looked up to, and I had a younger brother and a younger sister that I looked out for, so...
Looked up to and looked out for.
Yes.
That's what it means to be in the middle.
That's what it was for me.
Uh-huh. Was that something that Dad or Mom instilled in you, that you were responsible for that?
No, I think I felt a responsibility, you know, for my siblings. We're a very close family, not just within the immediate family, but an extended family. And so, you know, I always felt... That bond with my siblings and the wider family.
So Cameron, your mom and dad picked up and moved from Pakistan to Manchester, England.
Mm-hmm.
And then you and your then girlfriend, now wife, picked up and moved from Manchester, England to here.
Yes.
So you're following in the family tradition, but why did you do that?
Well, I mean, the reason I did it was that I was working for a U.S. software company who was in the search space, and they had asked me to help out with some management requirements in the U.S. Initially, I was reluctant to do it for a long period of time, so I agreed to do it for a short period of time, but that initial 6 months turned out to be 12 months, and now is, I guess, 15, 16 years, which my wife reminds me quite often.
And you've since become a U.S. citizen. Tell us about that process.
You know, I came here on a visa, and the process is that you essentially have a visa. You then apply to become a green card holder, which gives you near citizenship. But then following that, after about 4 or 5 years, you can apply to become a U.S. citizen. And so we decided we wanted to do that.
It's a very lengthy process that you had to endure.
It is, yeah. I mean, the whole process from start to finish was probably, you know, a good 10 years.
The
average. From the initial visa that you come here on all the way through to becoming a citizen, it's probably about 10 years. So it's a long time, and it's an emotional investment because you've got to make these applications and to become a citizen.
But why
you have
go through
test.
All that?
You know, we have had 2 children in the U.S. They were born in Georgetown, so they're U.S. citizens, and so we felt that we wanted to be able to do things as simple as vote. Right? We weren't allowed to vote as green card holders, and we felt that, you know, we've made a commitment to the U.S. and we wanted to become citizens, and so that's why we decided that.
How did you feel at the naturalization ceremony?
You know, it was very interesting. I didn't think that. I thought it was going to be very procedural, but it turned out to be, you know, a great experience actually, because you have a number of people who talk to you about what it means to be a U.S. citizen, and there's a whole bunch of people from many different forms of life who've come from all over the world. And so for me, it was actually a lot more engaging and interesting than I thought it was going to be. And I remember that day very well.
What is it about that either surprised you or that you learned about yourself?
The actual ceremony.
Going through that whole process and the ceremony, which became very emotional for you.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was really that, you know, here I was making a big commitment to the U.S. and that, you know, I'd gone through quite a lengthy process to get there. And I think it was very much relief, and also to be a member of a community now in the fullest sense so that I could vote. I mean, I think this was probably 2007, and there was an important election coming up the year after, and for me, I remember getting increasingly frustrated that I couldn't vote. And so when I became a citizen, the first thing I thought was, now I can cast a vote in what was going to be an important year. And so I was very glad that I became a citizen before the 2008 election.
That's great, Cameron. Cameron, what's the website address?
It's www.searchtechnologies.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Cameron Kahn, President and CEO of Search Technologies. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn & Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, But I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohen & Burnett?
CohenAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A-N-D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohen, founder of Cohen & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohen. For this segment, we have Kevin O'Prey, President and CEO of Obsidian Analysis. Welcome, Kevin.
Well, thank you.
Kevin, what is Obsidian Analysis?
Obsidian is a professional services firm. We're about 4 years old, and we operate mostly in the federal space doing management consulting. So we essentially do policy analysis, program analysis, and run exercises and simulations for the government as well as some private sector clients.
And how did you get started with the business?
I've been working in this space, having come out of the think tank community, and a partner and I set this up in 2010, and I'd been doing it out of my house for a couple of years and decided it was time to scale up and actually build a company out with it.
So you didn't start here. You actually started this up. You were working elsewhere before that. What possessed you to actually start your own company?
I had my own company, but I was working out of my house. And actually, my wife was the president. I worked for her, and she was a great boss. I'd recommend it to anybody. And in this case, I literally was working as many hours as was humanly possible and realized, okay, it's time to start leveraging this a little bit and getting together with some partners.
Mm-hmm. And how big or small is it now?
We're 60 people, or coming up on 60 people, and coming up on $20 million this year. We started, our first year was $400,000 in 2010, so we've grown a bunch.
And you have other partners, you said earlier.
Yeah, I founded it with one principal partner, and we had two friends come along for the ride at the beginning. So there were really four of us to start, but it's really co-owned by myself and by me and my partner.
Mm-hmm. And how do you decide who runs it and who doesn't run it? How did you work through that?
So we've been friends a long time. We're both New York Giants fans, and that helps. So we've been through things thick and thin. I think we have a good rhythm together, and most of the decisions we reach are collaborative, and we work with each other's strengths. And actually, the original idea is that he was going to run the company, and I was going to do most of the outward-facing piece. But then we had a big project that we were lucky enough to take over, and he volunteered to take over running the project himself, so he couldn't be the president. So I volunteered to do that, and it's collaborative. We work with each other.
So where does collaboration show up for you? When did it first show up for you, I should say?
Collaboration. Well, that's a hard thing because, I've never really had a successful roommate relationship in my life. I think, it's really based on, I'd say this is probably the first, becoming a dad, becoming a father, the first really successful collaborative enterprise I've had in raising my daughter with my wife, and taught me empathy, taught me how to compromise. And as a consequence, I think I'm probably a better partner in business today.
Really?
No doubt.
So empathy and compromise, those are things that partners do?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. You got to understand where your partner's coming from. You have to be able to read communications, both verbal and nonverbal. You have to really understand what things are red lines with your partner, what things are negotiable. So those are important things.
And being married is good practice at that.
Yes, absolutely. But I would say beyond being married, being a parent, being a good parent, because you're in a collaborative enterprise, and you're focused on achieving something bigger than yourself.
Mm-hmm. How important is that in what you do with the folks who work with you and for you?
Well, actually, becoming a parent was the best thing that ever happened for me as a manager or leader, because I've always been somebody who was much more oriented towards pushing people as opposed to leading or managing folks. And if I were to critique myself pre becoming a dad, it would be somebody who drove people way too hard. And sorry.
So what's the difference between pushing someone as a leadership style and leading someone?
I think going back to empathy and going back to collaboration, it's listening to people, understanding what motivates them. It's trying to encourage and lead by example, but also setting out in a system of incentives and working with somebody and recognizing their strengths and limitations as opposed to just saying do it.
So it'd be more of the carrot than the stick?
Carrot, but also diplomacy. Yes, carrots, because that's incentives, but I think also, listening, understanding the person you're talking to, I think that's important.
So when did that skill set really become paramount for you?
As
growing up, go ahead.
Oh, growing up, not at all. No, no. I've always been somebody who's self-reliant and was, you know, my way the highway. So I wouldn't say that I had that much in my background at all.
So when did it begin to show up for you?
Really becoming a dad, no question.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Was that?
Absolutely.
You also, education-wise, you have what?
I have a doctorate from MIT in political science.
So you were on an academic and research path?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was very interested in the Cold War. I was very interested in the Soviet Union, the U.S.-Soviet competition. Then 1989 happened. The Cold War ended, more or less. Had a retool. Went into the think tank community and really enjoyed that until I realized that nobody was reading the books I was writing, and really started to move more into the private sector and with a particular focus on working in the government space doing policy analysis.
So why was it important that actually people read your books or at least hear what you're thinking?
Well, everybody wants to, you get into that business because you think you have good ideas and want to share them and want to influence people. And if it takes a year for someone to get actually see the book that is now outdated, which is a real problem during the collapse of the Soviet Union, one starts to look for ways to have their influence or their ideas articulated faster and more effectively.
Mm-hmm. And in the work you do, is that important?
Absolutely. I think what we're trying to do is help, especially government, private sector clients, make smart decisions to grapple with hard problems. And, you know, if we can communicate effectively, if we can analyze their problems well and help them solve those, I mean, time is paramount. And that's it's something that we get a charge out of and I get a lot of satisfaction out of.
So, Kevin, what were you like as a kid?
So I was a ne'er-do-well through about junior year in high school. I think I hadn't quite found my path. And, you know, dead-end kid might be a good description. You know, I had great parents. One, dad was a cop. Mom was a teacher. So, you know, good civil servants.
Public service and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Civil servants and highly committed. But I had a long leash, and I think I went out to the end of that leash. And around junior year, I realized I was failing all my classes or a couple of them in high school, and I had to sort myself out. So I sort of turned around, and at that point, I think, got really serious about what I was trying to accomplish.
Who was the disciplinarian there?
Neither.
Neither?
No, no.
So neither one of them were reining you in at all?
I think, you know, through expressions, they were trying to rein me in. But I had a long leash, and I'm probably the one who ultimately made the decision that it's, okay, time to do something with this.
How did that happen? What triggered that?
I think the recognition that I was I was the bottom half of my class by the time I graduated, but I was on the way to being at the bottom of my class, you know, by the end of my sophomore year. And I think it was failing classes and looking around at the people I was failing classes with and realizing that this is probably not the group of people that I wanted to be with for the rest of my life.
Mm. And mom was a teacher, you said.
Your mom was a teacher, and by that point, she'd actually gone to work for United Airlines. So she was in the airline industry as a reservation person. When you call somebody 1-800 number, that's who you got.
How did she influence you in all of this?
So my mom never, to my memory, took a sick day in her entire life. So she was somebody who worked hard and you know, through her retirement, worked hard. And that certainly set a standard for me, although it wasn't necessarily evident during the ne'er-do-well phase.
Mm-hmm. And what about dad?
Dad was a cop, and he, you know, probably if I were to attribute things, strengths to him or things I take away from there, it's certainly a commitment to public service. And he listened a lot. As a cop being successful, you had to listen to people.
What did you learn from your grandparents?
From my grandparents. So most of them, unfortunately, passed away by the time I was mature to appreciate such things. But the main ones, my grandfather and father's side emigrated here from Northern Ireland and became a policeman, like a lot of Irish people did, and they migrated here. And he was just somebody who was very serious, and I'd just say a good man. Certainly recognize him as a good-hearted person who was firmly committed to helping people.
You also said something to us in the green room about two words that probably would define you back then, perhaps still today, energy and shame. Can you elaborate on that real quickly for us?
So energy and shame. So energy is work hard at everything you do. And whatever you're doing, you know, give it a good shot and, you know, don't leave anything on the field in the sports metaphor.
That's working hard and doing well, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like, you know, no matter what situation, when I recommend to folks when they're looking for jobs, it's like, you know, there are a lot of people with a lot of skills. You gotta be harder working than everybody else and make a difference. On the shame side, it's like recognize your name's behind every product, and that's something we do in our company. And it's like what you put out there is something that reflects on you, and you better better feel good about what your name's attached to it.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. What's the website address, Kevin?
www.obsidiandc.com.
We've been speaking with Kevin O'Pray, President and CEO of Obsidian Analysis. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today. Mark, would you run through those names real quickly for us?
Sure, Les. Our first guest was Scott DiGiammarino, the CEO and founder of Real Potential. Second was Jim Burris, the President and CEO of Ashburn Consulting. Third was Cameron Kahn, the President and CEO of Search Technologies. And we've just heard from Kevin O'Pray, President and CEO of Obsidian Analysis.
Thank you, Mark. This is your host, Les Smolin, and I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn, for helping with the interviews, hopefully delivering to our listening audience an entertaining and educational show. And I'd like to thank our listening audience for listening. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can also hear this program again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
It's Mike Jakaitis at the editor's desk. Join the Crits for Life Colon Cancer Foundation and WTOP at the 4th Annual Blue Hope Bash Gala on Thursday, October 16th at the Four Seasons Hotel in Georgetown. It's going to be a great evening with live entertainment, speeches from special guests, dinner, cocktails, silent auction, and inspirational stories from colon cancer survivors. So come on out and support as we go beyond the limits, elevating the need to talk about colon cancer, the prevention, and research advancements. For event details and tickets, visit chrisforlife.org/Blue Hope Bash.
The 14th Annual March of Dimes Heroines of Washington Gala will honor women who exemplify leadership and are making a difference in our community. From CEOs to rising stars, this year's finalists will be recognized for their significant volunteer contributions at a Black Tie Awards presentation on Tuesday, November 18th at the Ritz-Carlton Tyson's Corner. All proceeds from Heroines of Washington will benefit the March of Dimes mission to give all babies a healthy start in life. Since 2001, the event has given awards to 80 heroines and has raised more than $1.7 million to support the March of Dimes effort to help women have full-term, healthy pregnancies and healthy babies. To learn more about the March of Dimes, to purchase tickets to Heroines of Washington, and make a donation, visit marchofdimes.org/heroines. Join them in celebrating these inspiring women who go above and beyond to improve our community.
Join the Washington Prayer Gathering October 13th at 1 p.m. at the Lincoln Memorial to pray for the city of Washington, D.C. Pastors from all ethnic backgrounds and denominations will join together to pray for the spiritual and physical needs of Washington. Plan to bring your whole family to this event Monday, October 13th, 1 p.m. at the Lincoln Memorial. For more information or to register your church to participate, visit WashingtonPrayerGathering.com. That's WashingtonPrayerGathering.org. Also find them at Facebook.com/DC Praise.
The second annual 2014 Wounded Warrior Salute Charity Golf Tournament will be held at 1757 Golf Club on Friday, October 17th at 10 a.m. This event will benefit wounded men and women service members through WWP, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to honor and empower wounded warriors. WWP empowers warriors with the tools essential to not just survive their injuries, but to thrive and achieve personal and professional success. The Salute Charity Golf Tournament is committed to the Wounded Warrior Project and the service members that WWP proudly serves. This organized event also supports Hire Our Heroes, sister charity to WWP. Hire Our Heroes makes impact daily, assisting veterans with resume writing, social media training, and connecting with employers looking to hire veterans. For more information on how to participate, sponsor, or become a volunteer, please go to WoundedWarriorSalute.org. That's WoundedWarriorSalute.org. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not